Backstage with Mothership on Solid Rock Radio begins now. Hear the best in new music, artist interviews, stories from the road, and more. You are now backstage, and here's your host, Mothership.
Hey, everybody. My guest today is Travis Weirich, music producer, composer, mixer, and engineer, and owner of Lakeside Studios in Knoxville, Tennessee.
How are you doing? How was Germany?
Oh, my goodness. Germany was wonderful. I got home about almost exactly 24 hours ago. So, you know, this is your show. Man, that place was packed out.
Who are the big draws? I know times are changing. Who's the big boy?
Actually, there was a packed room for everybody, but the headliners, Cutlass, Disciple, and Petra.
Oh, that's right. I saw that. And let me, you know this. Kevin Young would rather meet them than Elvis Presley or Michael Jackson.
Oh, he made sure that we knew that.
Oh, yeah.
Petra brought it. 70-year-old men.
There you go, yeah.
And I mean, John Schlitt was jumping up and down. I'm like, how in the world? And when they came back into catering, they got a standing ovation from the bands that were back there.
You know, they broke down the walls that, you know, even Disciple was facing back in the day, that we shouldn't be doing this. And there was no room in the industry for this kind of music. And, you know, I do remember, you know, when working with the PODs and the Pillars and Disciples and all that stuff, those meetings, you get to hear what they're up against. And it was fascinating to me because I was very green. You know, I wasn't saved when I started working with Disciple. They actually led me to Christ. And just to sit there and go, wait, y'all are being persecuted or this isn't allowed because of what? I just was very clueless to how much struggle they had had for decades. And we were still having, and I suppose the 90s, right? Is that Disciple's first records?
Yes, 90s. Yeah, it was amazing. And Disciple, holy cow.
Yeah.
They were like on fire.
You know, obviously his band's half his age and Kevin has the mind of a 20-year-old. But yeah, I mean, there's no question when your heroes might be on side stage, you're going to do a triple back flip axle and land it right on point.
That's right.
Kevin's psychotic. I still to this day, because, you know, he and I go obviously way back. I toured for 14 years and I just couldn't do it anymore. I was at a different place in my life. And he asked me back in the day, it was just one of those slow days where we're kind of working. And he goes, hey, so I used to come see your band play and y'all played all the time and you were 100%. And one day you just walked away. Why? And I said, I often ask myself that. And Kevin's held on to this. I said, honestly, I feel like God took the chip out of my brain that longed to be on the stage. And I said, now, Kevin, please understand, I never played in the name of Christ. I was in a secular rock band. I played for us and for me and the love of music. And so because he's curious when to walk away, when do I become a preacher like, you know, Rob from Pillar? And, you know, he got his doctrine back in the day to be a preacher 15 years ago. So he'll always say, God hadn't taken the chip out yet. You know, how old is he?
Should 40, I say no.
40-ish.
Yeah, 40-ish.
Yeah, he still can't wait, you know. But he's a preacher, you know. They're real. They go out and spread the gospel.
So you've been playing the guitar for a pretty long time. And you're a vocalist, too, I heard. You have a beautiful voice.
I don't know about that. Thank you, though. I consider myself a guitar player, and I have an ear, so I can sing. I think that's why I'm able to produce, and that's why I love working with singers. But I can harmonize with a pretty voice, but I wouldn't say I have a nice voice. But if someone has a beautiful voice and I'm doing harmony, I can, you know, I feel more comfortable. That's for sure. But no, I got a guitar when I was 13. It's the only job I've ever had is music. I've never really worked anywhere because I'm just kind of high strung. All my bands will tell you that. But I just get up early and I try to outwork yesterday. You know, it's just a mindset I have. I'm kind of a carpe diem seize the day. And so I just got obsessed with guitar. I was in a band playing shows by the time I was 15 or 16. And we were the big high school band, you know. In hindsight, we were horrible, but we thought we were amazing. And so when we graduated high school, we started touring. And we toured for 14 years, I think we did all that. And we had a good run.
You were born in Atlanta, right?
Born in Atlanta, but for the most part, Knoxville, Tennessee is where I've lived my whole life, yes. You kind of want to live in a place off the grid a little bit, you know, so you can unwind. The bands love it here because it's just peaceful. The labels love it because the hotels are cheap and they can per diem. You know, it's not Nashville or New York or something. Nashville's gotten out of hand. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so my band was doing well in the secular world. We were playing, we were popular. We were touring with Bon Jovi, Bad Company, Steppenwolf, Peter Frampton. I mean, we were doing
Right.
So, we were doing great. We were actually in negotiations with Sony Music. I believe her name was Marnie Smith. We were starting to pick out the songs, and this was a point in my life where I still thought it had to be all this insane guitar and music and that everything mattered. And the songs they were picking were these simple songs I had written in 5 minutes, but they were good hooks. They were good choruses. And I remember having these meetings where they're going, no. Did you listen? Yeah. Great. Whatever. This song. And I was like, so it really started to open my eyes to what made me a producer, which was it's about the song. It's about the story. It's about the voice. And drums, bass, guitar. Great. I always tell my bands, your job is to not mess up this record. Do great. But that vocalist has to be so sincere with everything he does, because the music we fall in love with, when you hear that singer, Lacey from Flyleaf, oh my gosh, when she sings, you just sit there and go, every speck of her existence believes these lyrics.
Yes, sir.
And that's the Matt. You could even say that with country and folk and hip hop and all that. But so I just really fell in love with that side of it. All of a sudden, we were in negotiations. We were actually kind of starting to contract and pick songs. And she called back and said, hey, so we're going up to Seattle. There's something going on. You know, we don't know what it is. So we're all going up this weekend. Came back about 2 weeks later. She said, Travis, I've got some weird news. She said, we are not allowed to sign any rock bands. We don't know what's going on, but we can't give away our big bands right now. And everyone's freaking out on this whole Seattle thing. Well, it was Pearl Jam. It was Alice in Chains, Nirvana. And so at that point, they back out of the deal. Cindy, I'd been doing music live for 14 years. I had lost passion for what our band was about 3 years before. But back then, you know this, if we sign a deal, you're talking millions out of the gate. Like, everyone gets $100,000, get on the bus, we're going to, you know. She even said, had you given me this record 3 years ago, I would have put you out with my best band and thrown everything I had at you. But right now, I can't give this stuff away. And then grunge happened. So it's funny, Cindy, I was relieved. You would think I'd be heartbroken, but it was kind of like having this Bitcoin and it might be worth $80,000 one day, but all of a sudden you find out it's worth $1. So I was able to sell it, which was quit the band. And we did it, you know, we all decided, hey, we had a great run. We knew going in that was, you know, little to no chance, especially in secular, you know, super rock era. You know, I quit the band and I really didn't know what I was going to do, when I was going to do it. And at that time, the Disciple guys were probably teenagers. And they and another band, Nails, Scotty Holand, they kept asking me if I would record their band, because I had recorded my band out of probably a little bit of control freak. Every time we'd go in the studio, the records didn't sound like I thought they were supposed to sound. In my brain, I wrote them to do this, and they were doing this. Uh-huh. And so I started just buying equipment on my own. We had no money. I mean, we were a very low-income family. I don't know what you call it. I wouldn't say poor, because I think that's kind of a state of mind thing. But we did not have a lot of resources. There you go. And I pieced together this record, you know, with paper clips and chewing gum, and it was a did well. It actually won Best Record of the Year in Knoxville and all these cool things where people were going to these studios. So Disciple and Nailed were asking me if I would record and produce them. When in my mind, I was like, well, no, I'm a guitar teacher. I'm a session player. I'm not a producer. I'm not a recording studio. They're like, yeah, I get it. But would you record us? And I would say no. And then finally, Scotty would not give up. He said, look, how much do you make teaching guitar? X. Okay, we'll pay you X and we'll take, you know, 8 hours a day and we'll do a record. I was like, all right, that sounds fine. So Nailed was the first band I'd really done. And of course, they got signed to Rugged. Disciple came in shortly after. We did that record. That would have been what was I thinking? And they're kids. You know the timeline. These are little kids.
Right.
But you know, they were great. And for the first time, Cindy, I worked in the studio with people that were not in my band. And it was so refreshing to bounce off of Kevin Young and go, wow, he's really, really talented in these areas. And let's chase that. Or Brad, wow, he can do this. If he can do this, then we should make the record do this. And so, you know, with my band, I had learned what they could and couldn't do, and that's what we did. So it really opened a door of curiosity. And people ask me all the time when they sit in on the session, some of them are peaceful, some of them are psychotic, some of them look like, you know, interventions with an alcoholic uncle, you know, but the goals are the same. To get the best out of everybody and make a record that we're so proud of at all costs, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I've crossed the line over the years with, you know, treating people a certain way and stuff. And I, you know, but my intentions were always good. But, you know, if there was a bass player that wasn't pulling his weight, I'll let him know it. You know, it's just kind of how I ran things.
Backstage with Mothership returns after this. Out Performance Shop is a proud supporter of Solid Rock Radio. They specialize in retail and wholesale of automotive, high performance, racing, and off-road products. They also carry a variety of accessories from remote control cars to rock and roller multi-carts. On the web at outperformance.com.
Yeah, so anyway, Disciple and Nail took off. Well, Pillar loved Disciple's record. They just loved that big guitar, and nobody in Christian was doing that. So when they got signed to Flickr, which were the Audio Adrenaline Boys, they were looking for producers. And, you know, they did all that, went through all the stuff in Nashville, and they kept going. And Danny, one of their managers, kept playing a Disciple record. He goes, "We need these guitars on our record. We want to be a rock band." And I was the guy that was going to get those guitars. I think I got Kevin to sing on the first Pillar record just as a cool, like, wow. And I think I got Sarah Anthony on a Pillar record, Rob and I did, because they were trying to up and come and we were trying to pay it forward, you know. And so at that point, I think it turned into a God thing because, you know, we ended up buying a house. The whole basement I turned into literally what I was calling just my personal studio for my hobby. And I always called it Noah's Ark back then because I had no idea why, you know, I thought I was building this, you know, me room. And then God just starts sending me all these Christian bands. I mean, I'd have to, you know, get a calendar up because it was so long ago. But I've never advertised, Cindy. It's the weirdest thing. I don't advertise. I don't buy spots in magazines. I don't pay for it. God just sends. And I've done mostly secular the last 2 or 3 years.
It's word of mouth, man.
Yeah, it is. And I always joke, if I make 3 bad records in a row, they're going to stop calling. So I need this record today to be good. Well, a lot of my bands are secular. A lot of my artists are secular. My favorite moments are when one of them at lunch will jump in my car and go, "Hey, man, so tell me what happened when you got saved." Because I had a reputation. I was wild, as an understatement. I mean, you did not want your kids hanging around with me. And then all of a sudden I wasn't. And so that's the door they open, and I get to tell them my testimony. Dozens and dozens of people over the years, you know, God has used making an EP or a record as an opportunity to just lock someone in a studio for 7 hours a day. And, you know, I don't Bible bash. I don't beat people over the head with a Bible. Never worked. But you just throw a story out there that's vulnerable, or you tell an experience you had. And, you know, a lot of people are just beat to death from some crazy church experience where nothing godly was happening, and they blame God for that. I'm like, no, that's the failure of man. You got to make sure you keep those separate. You know, church is perfect till you put a man in there or a woman, and then it becomes imperfect, and you've got to, you know, not blame God for this. So yeah. I don't know. It's been neat to see that. And, you know, again, here I am still making records.
When did your studio get the name Lakeside Studios?
Okay, funny story. Rugged Records was Nailed, and I literally, he didn't get Disciple. He just, you know, because they were a little flashback of the 80s back before that was cool. Now that's real cool. And I just kind of kept hounding the guy at the label. I said, "Dude, they're great. People love them. I've been to their shows. Like, people are like giving their life to Christ." Kind of begged my way into that first record. It was one of their largest selling records ever. So then all of a sudden, you know, Rugged loved Disciple. And I think Warner bought them out at some point. I don't remember all the timeline stuff. You could probably Google it. So it was my personal studio, and it was called My Studio, and my band, MI with a line over it, My Studio. And Rugged, the guy, was right. He goes, "Hey, do you mind changing the name of your studio?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I just want it to look more professional, and My Studio doesn't look professional." I'm like, "Yeah, that's fine." So, you know, 2 months of like trying to figure out a name. And he actually said, I was near this little spring fed bluegrass lake. He said, "What about Lakeside Studios?" I was like, "Dude, that's kind of cool." So we named it. Uh-huh. Well, Cindy, I'm in a different house right here than we did the Above record and two of the Disciple records. This house would have been Pillar of the Reckoning. I think Shinedown even did some stuff still here. Disciple would have been Scar Remains. Yeah, would have been in the new place. Pillar kind of brought up the, hey, we love recording with you, but your studio's kind of small. We've been touring like crazy. Any chance you would consider building a bigger studio before the next record? And in my mind, I'm like, oh, dude, there's no way. You know, once you put blood, sweat, and tears into building. And I just told my wife at the time about it. She said, well, Travis, I mean, why not? I was like, well, we couldn't afford it. You know, we could barely afford the house we had. And so she started looking, and about 3 months later, she found this house. And it's on the lake, Cindy. It's on the Tennessee River. Because in my mind, I kept thinking, well, I have to change the name. You know, it's going to be Doghouse Studios or, you know. And, yeah, and then it was a 10-year-old house. But when I walked through the basement, I was like, this is it. This is amazing. And, I mean, we had no business getting this house. And you know the story. God just lined up all these scenarios that allowed a musician to buy a house in the first place, you know. So, and, you know, God was just blessing us. So, yeah. I'm thankful for this. We've made a lot of great records in here in the name of Christ, and we've had a lot of secular records in here where Christ would influence. Because, you know, they'll go and look in the wall and see all those things and, you know, what's a Dove Award? And, you know, it's like a Grammy for Christian, and that one was this, and this was, really, you know, and I'll tell these backstories, and then they're all of a sudden like, so there's a whole industry of Christian music, because they don't know. You know, they have no idea. I'll give them a link. Hey, go listen to this band. One of my buddies, and I won't say his name, but like he was just kind of no religion. I got him hooked on Chevelle in the Glory Years because I knew it was right up his alley. And about a month later, he goes, hey, man, are they a Christian band? And I was like, I don't know. I don't really keep up. You know, the lyrics are amazing. You know,
how important is the environment of a studio to making a good recording?
I think it's everything. We obviously live in a time where you can grab a laptop and go down to, you know, the Bahamas and make a hip hop record. But, you know, there's something about it. Wuv loves this studio, the drummer for POD. He and I had worked together for 6 years, but we were always in different studios because of their crazy schedule. And they would fly me all over the place and the label would spend all this money. And we were working out the date once with I finally just told their manager, I said, guys, I know you've never heard of Knoxville, Tennessee, but trust me. My studio's bigger, nicer, and has better gear than half of the places y'all send me to. We end up renting all this equipment. And so they were kind of uncomfortable, and they did. And literally, Wuv walked in here like, dude, why have we never come here? Said it was his second favorite studio to ever record in. It was recorded every Sunny, too. I just think the vibe is everything, you know. And even emotionally, you know, when some people come in and they're like wired negative to, oh, I'm going to suck or I'm going to do, I'll literally stop everything and go, hey, man, let's have a talk. Like, I want you to do me a favor. I don't want you to start sentences negatively. I can't do this. Or I just don't believe in that. On paper, shouldn't be able to do any of the things I do.
Yeah.
But for some reason, if you told me to build something and I had no idea what I was doing, I would be inclined to think I could do it. I don't think that's arrogant or pride. I just think I'm curious if I can myself. Yeah. I had a dollar for every person who told me I could never make a living doing this. I would have paid my house off.
Well, but you've been doing this for about 20 years.
So 25 years.
Okay.
Because we were doing the math, you know, Fireproof's 20-year reunion was this year, and we weren't able to get the masters, you know, they got bought out. We were heartbroken. We wanted to do remixes and get Lester on the record. We had the best intentions, and we could never find the master, which is just heartbreaking to me. Well, we did half of it in some studio that did Radar back in the day, and that's just a weird format for me anyway. I was analog tape purist forever. So this next year will be where do we go from here? And I have the masters. I have multiple copies on multiple hard drives. I've got one in a fireproof safe. So we will be freshening up those records. But, I mean, that's 20 years ago. And you're talking, that's Pillar's third record I did. So it'd have to be 25, 30 years of this stuff.
Wow. So you went through the digital takeover.
I fought it forever. I fought it forever because I did one record digitally on ADATS. And I didn't know why at the time, but I'm like, what's wrong with this? Something doesn't feel real to me. And, you know, now I know why. But so I held on to analog tape forever. We did a lot of stuff analog. Where people are like, oh, we've got ADATs. We're so much far advanced than you. And I'm like, that's fine with me. It doesn't hurt my feelings, but tape just sounds amazing. And down the road, when the converters got better, I've got a lot of vintage old Neve preamps that kind of grunge and girth it up. And then you take a picture with digital of old nasty rock and roll. Then I like my rock and roll to be on digital. You know, I think if you record with the pristine digital pres and converters, if you're doing classical records or pop, that's good. But even the hip hop and R&B and some of the country, you've got to have that vintage dirt, just grunge. It's just that old gear throws up in the coolest ways, you know, and so.
You're a passionate man.
I am. I nerd out on that stuff. I read articles and watch YouTube every day about something that, you know, somebody's doing somewhere just to try to get better at what I do.
Listening to Backstage with Mothership on Solid Rock Radio. Check us out on Facebook at I'm with Mothership.
You already mentioned being positive. How else do you pull things out of your artists or your vocalists?
You know, morale is different. So it's funny because I had a bunch of doctors in here doing what I call bucket list records. You know, they're very successful, but they always wanted to do a record. So they come in and, you know, I had an anesthesiologist, an eye doctor, an ER doctor, and the guitar player tracking. And then I had him singing. Drummer noticed, you know, he'd been back there for 4 hours watching me. And he and I are friends. When everybody left to go outside, he goes, so this is 80% psychology. I said, yes, it is. I said, everyone can sing in G major. Now that autotune is here, everyone can sing in tune in G major. But when Barry Manilow does it or when James Hetfield does it, it's different. Why is it different? Because of their emotions. And so to me, I've got to almost like a psychiatrist diagnose their triggers. Sometimes it's an easy trigger. Sometimes it's a painful trigger. Like Sarah Anthony, you know, we talked about some tough stuff. And, you know, she's a dear friend of mine. I've known her since she was probably 15 years old, I guess. See, it's how long we've been working together. But we kind of know if the content on this song is here, then she and I will sit there and just talk about an adjective, whether it be sorrow or happiness. You know, you got to get them emotionally there. And then we'll be talking. And I'll go, hey, go in that vocal booth real quick. And someone I've worked with will know, oh, I see what he's saying. You know, a newbie will go, well, wait a minute. Let me go warm up and do a, you know, triple backflip and do all my little. I was like, no.
You know when they're ready.
I don't want perfect vocals. I want real vocals. Bruce Springsteen never sang in key, and he makes a good living. So, yeah, I mean, I think singer-wise, now, if someone's bucking up or trying to be stubborn, the biggest thing you got to do, Cindy, is don't let them sing. Once they start singing, it's just choral. It becomes cabaret. And so then I'll stop and go, hey, tell me the lyrics to that chorus. And they'll go, and I'll go, okay, cool. Come on in. Let's go to lunch. You know, let's talk about the day you wrote this song, because 6 months later, you forgot what these words were. And I got to get them to remember back when their mother died and they wrote this song, because about 3 months later, it becomes a melody they sing in the car because they want to make it a song. And so I almost have to digress and get them back to the rawness of this line's awesome. Why did you write that line? Well, and they'll tell me and they'll start to crack in their voice. And I'm like, that's where you have to be in front of a microphone. I always say, what are the two adjectives that describe this storyteller? What do you mean? Well, is he happy or is he heartbroken? Oh my gosh, I've never thought of that. Two adjectives that describe him. Man, he's so pissed off at the world and he is borderline psychotic. Okay, so let's go pissed off and psychotic and I'll roll tape, you know?
Wow.
If I'm thankful, you know, Kevin's great at this now. He and I just go through the motions, but he knows how to get thankful. He knows how to get mad without me working him up. You know, anyone I've done multiple records with kind of knows, well, this is how Travis prepares me. So I'm going to try to get a head start on it.
Well, no flexing, but you've got like 30 number one hits, right?
Yeah, it's,
well, you know,
it's a blessing, man. I mean, I'm a little uncomfortable with that stuff, but I get it. And you hate, you know, utilizing your achievements. But, you know, when you're trying to get someone to take you serious, sometimes you got to pull out the resume and go, hey, you know this, right?
Give us a short list of some of the folks you've worked with so people can.
Oh, gosh. I mean, Dolly Parton, Charlie Daniels, Ricky Skaggs, Disciple, P.O.D., Shinedown, the guitar player for Breaking Benjamin, about 7 years he's been in that band. Keith Wallins, his name's phenomenal talent. Obviously, Pillar. Gran Torino. Oh my gosh, I almost have to go look at the wall. Fiasco, Toby Mac. Yeah, it's funny. Spoken, love me some Spoken. Letter Black, love Letter Black.
All right, I know it's like choosing a favorite child, but do you have a particular project that comes to mind that was one of your most proud moments?
I would say Scars Remain was pretty cool for a lot of reasons. I really felt like the band was finding out who they were, and I felt like we were finally, as engineers, mixers, and guitar players and drummers, and we were finally getting to be able to do what we wanted it to sound like. And that was one of the records where you listen back and go, huh, that's kind of what we were trying to do. And man, they wrote some great songs. You know, there was some chaos in those days, but all records have levels of chaos. But I think the glory of that record outlined. Now, I will say Fireproof was fun, but the second one with Lester, Where Do We Go From Here? And then POD, I did Warriors 2, and I did Going In Blind and a couple others. Just because I was a POD fan, usually my bands I work with from day one, other than, of course, Dolly Parton and Ricky Skaggs and all that stuff. But POD, I loved them. So when I was asked to do it, I was like, okay, wow, this will be different. You know, I'm stepping into Howard Benson and Chris Lord-Alge, my heroes, and I'm going to be trying not to mess this up. So those were fun records, but I really became great friends with those guys that we still, you know, talk all the time. Going In Blind was a neat song that we did here at Lakeside that first time they'd ever been here. And they wrote and recorded the whole song in 2 days because they were at that point of their life. They played 2,000 shows. They could finish each other's thoughts. And it was the last recording with Jason Truby. Beautiful song that Sonny wrote on the spot in that chair right there in an hour. You know, and I'm turning around going, I got singers complaining that 6 months isn't enough time to write a song. And this guy has the hook in verse one before lunch. I mean, he is amazing.
Wow. I saw a video once of you cleaning your studio while you had a band in there.
Oh, yeah. OCD. Yeah. Well, I think I have controllable anxiety. I'm high strung. I've never been proven on the spectrum. And I get things done, but yeah, like if there's dust over there, I've got to stop and go take care of that dust. I've learned to control it more than it controls me, but I make no promises, you know.
That tells me a lot about how you produce.
Yeah, you know, I tell people, if we're going to hit the budget we're wanting to hit, this stuff's got to be clean and tight. We've got to all know what we're doing. We'll have artsy moments, but we've still got to have a structure. And to me, cleanliness is structural. Everything is in order. When I go in that room, I know exactly where a mic is. You're never allowed to let go of anything until it's in its proper place.
It can be a blessing or it can be a curse.
That's so true. It can help you. If you let it control you, you'll get fired. You know, you will literally struggle. So
I wanted to touch on something because, you know, you've been around for a while. I have talked to some other producers, talked to bands that are very successful. And I think something that a lot of them have in common is they have this imposter syndrome going on. Do you ever have that?
You know, sometimes it catches me off guard. I'll be looking at old photos and I'm like, I'm just so blessed in a, you know, I don't want it to sound weird or arrogant, but I just can't believe what God's done in my life, the people he's put in my life. You know, it's not me making these 30 number one hits. It's them. I just had to squeeze them a little harder than they were comfortable with to get them to number one. But yeah, I mean, it is funny because sometimes you sit there and think, wow. You know, I've had some crazy stories in my life. My childhood was tough. There's a lot of darkness and all that, but I just choose to wake up and think positive every day. I don't reflect on the darkness of my past. So again, I just feel blessed in all of that.
Before you go, one more band story.
You pick a band, I'll tell you a story.
Okay.
What band would you want to hear about?
Pillar.
Noah and Rob and I are both like, hey, the session's over. Let's go skydiving. Hey, let's go, you know, whatever. Let's go to Gallenberg and eat a funnel cake. And the other two would just go to the hotel room and stare at their computer, Lester and Mike. And they wouldn't mind me saying that. So one night I was like, Dave Mustaine was supposed to come in the studio for 2 days the next day. And, you know, I mean, I grew up secular. I knew exactly who that was. And Noah worshipped him. And I said, hey, guys, it snowed on Gatlinburg. It's about an hour from here. I said, let's go snowboarding tonight. Oh, cool. They'd never been. So we get snowboards and we go up there. And of course, all you do is fall for, you know, 4 hours. All this being said, Noah came in the next day and his forearms were so sore, he could barely play. And he was looking at me like, Travis, I can't move my arms. My hero is right there and I can't play guitar. And it was just like, dude, it's calm down. It's a, but I know what he's talking about. You know, you get all that lactic acid. And
right.
So he went out in the other room and tried to warm up. But it was funny because Dave was here for a few days and he was a really, really nice guy. And it was neat to work with him. I mean, he's obviously a rock and roll legend. But, you know, to see Noah just in awe of this guy. Noah was new to the band. I mean, you know, he was still the kid in the band.
Yeah.
And to finally be able to get to play in front of your hero and your producer takes you out snowboarding and smashes your forearms for 4 hours. So, yeah, random funny story. I think I twisted my knee so bad I limped for 2 years that night. So, bad decision to snowboard before a very important session.
There you go. Don't
let that snowboard be a lesson to all of you.
I'm going to let you go. Thank you. Good night.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more great music. And check out my blog page on the Solid Rock Radio website for my guests' social media links. If you've missed any of my past interviews, you can find them uploaded to podcast.solidrockradio.org. Have a wonderful week, and let's be kind to one another.